the world needs an internet bill of rights. We need to decentralise the internet. We need to make sure that these corporations aren't controlling the information through their ideological persuasion. You guys aren't the arbiter of truth. We determine what the truth is ourselves, for ourselves, and so we need all the information to be able to make that decision, that informed decision.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth.
Kia ora and welcome. I'm Lisa Eyre and this is Green Planet FM. And today I'm interviewing Philip J. Watt, who is a clinical hypnopsychotherapist, author and public speaker who lives on the mid-north coast of New South Wales, Australia. His first book, The Simulation, is a daring exposé of the human experience in the 21st century. His other written and interview work deals with topics from spirituality to society, as well as self-development. He says, make no mistakes about it, there is a growing community of awakened people who are engaged in a core dialogue about what it means to be human at the start of the 21st century. This awakening is a natural evolution for human consciousness and is composed of two overarching parts. First is a deep realization of the innate interdependence that we have with the entirety of reality, regardless of if we look at it through the lens of ecology, quantum physics, or spirituality. The second is recognizing the social and systemic dysfunction that requires collective action to be transcended by redesigning our society to reflect the new era that humanity is adventuring into. Kia ora and welcome, Philip. It's really great to have you on the phone from Australia. Whereabouts was it?
I'm in Bellingen, which is on the mid-north coast of New South Wales, and thank you for inviting me on, Lisa.
Oh, look, I've been watching you on Facebook, on your website and everything since 2010. So I've been very interested in your journey, which kind of started out a little bit more on the spiritual side, and then it's almost like you've said, well, you know, we're spiritual beings having a physical experience, so you have to try and make the world better in the physical. Would that be correct?
Yeah, well, I went through my own education and revolution of mind, body, energy myself through that process. You must have tapped into me when I first initiated my introduction on the public stage through my writings and presentations, and I'm an author of a book, as well as the podcast and all the other things that I've been fortunate enough to be able to share with the world. But my journey did start out with the emancipation of my sort of ignorance around my inner connection with reality, with connection. I basically call spirituality, or describe spirituality, as honouring my connection with connection. And so that was the first thing I went through as a young adult, and then realised I was severely dysfunctional on many different levels of mind and body, and had to go through an emancipation process of that to alleviate things like pretty entrenched depression. Not that I was on diagnosed or on any pharmaceuticals about it. And through that process, then I ended up realising I wanted to give back in the world, because I now had an obligation to do so, because I had done some great work on myself, great introspection and realignment, and basically bringing my very, the many subcategories of health into coherence. And I was working pretty holistically and productively, and just having a lot of fun, and was able to really be playful and serious at the same time in this metaphysical game of magic, madness and mystery that we call our life. And so that was the sort of the process I went through personally. And then in my, professional representation of that, I did the same thing. And I focused on spirituality, symbolism, synchronicity, integration of shadow, the whole lot, not just about rainbows and unicorns, but dealing with all the yin and yang of life. And then obviously went into a lot of writings around how to take care of thyself and integrate thyself and heal thyself and ultimately develop thyself. And then I went into the social activism side of things because I've said this for a long time, Lisa, now, that there's that saying, I can't remember, I always forget who said this quote, but it's essentially, first I was clever and I wanted to change the world, then I was wise and I wanted to change myself. And I would add on to that and say, now I'm both clever and wise and I want to change myself and the world, essentially. So it's about not just doing the internal work and then radiating that out to the rest of reality. It's also about getting your hands dirty, getting your mind dirty, and really getting an idea about what the real problems that we face in this actual, you know, what you call the material realm, and in this from a sociological and political perspective, and then what are the actual potential solutions that we can apply right here, right now, instead of having any sort of weird romanticism about what we're going to do in the future. What can we do right here, right now? And so that's I invest a lot of my energy in helping people to come onto a pretty coherent page, a clear message for what we can do to resolve so many of our not just socioeconomic issues, but environmental ones and also sovereignty ones as well.
Well, you know, you and I are on exactly the same page. I just think you're doing it more effectively than I am. So,
well, I appreciate that.
No, well, you have a big following, really. And it's great what you're doing. And I noticed over the last couple of days that you've done a bit of commentating on the Australian elections, which happened last weekend. So it's been quite interesting from my perspective, looking at what's happened. I'm wondering if it's as soon as any political party accuses the other one of possibly raising any tax anywhere, everybody cries no and votes the other way.
Yeah, well, look, it was much deeper than that. There's philosophical concerns with the left and with environmentalism in general within Australia. Some people understand that. There are concerns around the signing of further agreements with the corporation known as the United Nations. Whilst there's some great people who work in the United Nations, as in any bureaucracy or government department or even the political spheres or whatnot, police, military, you name it, there's great people, great patriots everywhere. There's a big issue with the agendas behind the scenes and who are these multi-billionaires, trillionaires who own these international banks, corporations and institutions and, such as UN, IMF, BIS, all this sort of stuff. So there's a bit deep concerns on the ground here in Australia that we're selling out our sovereignty and already have sold out a lot of our individual and national freedoms through this interaction with these multi-billionaires. That's one big concern. There's also big concerns around how we operationalise our social system in response to some of the environmental degradation that is a very real reality. However, there is still some deep scientific debates around climate change, what that actually means, what carbon really means, given that it is a nutrient for plants, in terms of the wide-scale release of much carbon through our activities. I'm no expert on any of this, but I certainly don't believe the mainstream narrative when it comes to more or less anything. And I've done a lot of research into sun science and how the sun affects the climate. So there's just some key sort of things that some of the grassroots problems, grassroots people had with going to the left, which was considered quite extreme, quite far left at this point. I would say the tax issue does play a big role, or did play a big role in the decisions of many people within particular country areas and whatnot. There was also deals done with particular minor parties to ensure that that the left didn't have too much power. My personal position is I would prefer a minority government or a hung parliament at this stage, and that we get good senators in, good Aussies who really care about and understand the real deep issues that we have, because the mainstream narratives do not cover the big issues, the big discourse that we're having on the ground in the independent media and through grassroots. And so we're very concerned about this two-party system that has sold out our sovereignty and our rights even on many, many different levels, and more or less sold out our Commonwealth. That's really what it comes down to, what happened to the Commonwealth of Australia. It's been sold off, and we have one of the best constitutions ever developed in the modern world, and that has been completely disrespected on a couple of seriously key levels. And so that's the discourse we want to have about how we realign this government to the constitution, because after all, the people are the government, we are the government, so we need to make sure we're intelligent enough in terms of how we elect, but also how we force them to enact our will, because that's really what it comes down to. The Australian population have been quite apathetic for quite some time regarding politics, and I'm guilty of that too, most of us are, because we felt like it was just a scam, a sham, and it's very difficult to want to get involved when you feel so powerless against it. But ultimately now there are power shifts happening right around the world on many different levels, and it is super important that the people realise that they ultimately have the power, and we need to be properly educated, and as you mentioned prior to this talk, we need to rise above left and right political and sociological ideology, which obviously has some good on the left, some good on the right, and the rest of it is just rubbish and chuck it out. We can have an intelligent perspective on the different ideologies and how they might be able to coexist to ensure the appropriate operationalisation of our social system. And so, yeah, there's big power shifts going on behind the scenes, also on the surface with the people, grassroots. There's a lot of stuff changing. I'm hopeful about that. But at the same time, we've got a lot of things that we need to do, which I'll definitely touch on in a moment if you're happy to go through some of that stuff that you talked about prior to the interview. But it really is a golden opportunity right now to come together as a people and come and get a coherent message and an intelligent plan about what we truly need, which would appease the left and right factions of our world, because unfortunately we are divided and conquered on many, many deep philosophical but also more superficial practical levels as well, and that's really on us. It is up to us, the people, to organise this and to ensure its actualisation. And because the information's all out there, the internet has been both a blessing and a curse. It was decentralised, and now it's fully centralised, and it's all mostly centralised, and meaning that a few key big tech companies in Silicon Valley control the traffic, and therefore it's harder to navigate around that and actually get to the actual real information, not the information they want us to believe in. But we can still do it, and so that's our responsibility. If we want to advance ourselves as a species, if we want to consider ourselves an intelligent species, then we'll need to make sure that we are stepping up, regardless of what these multinational monopolies, not just media, but energy, petrochemical, banks, you name it, it's all been monopolised. And that's a big key.
And the industrial military machine.
That's right, yeah. It's all linked to great degrees. And all these, we need to understand that in response to the monopolisation of our world, including how the monopolies have stripped our Commonwealth here out of Australia, we've got to have an appropriate response. And the response is not rocket science. It's very easy. It is simply localisation. We've got globalisation, monopolisation issues, so we need to respond with localisation. We've got centralisation and authoritarian issues, so we need to respond with decentralisation and individual national sovereignty. And although that simple process, it gets a little bit more complicated when you put it into action, but essentially it just means that you need to have a balance on the spectrum. Like, of course, like with left and right, have a balance on the spectrum. Like with being playful and serious in life, have a balance between it. We don't have to go to extreme ends, and whilst we're never going to get rid of big corporations that want to, you know, control particular fields or production or whatever it may be, we've just got to make sure that we're smart in terms of how we respond to that and start making our communities, and which I know you're very fond of, Lisa, more self-sufficient in a way that we can insulate ourselves from whatever these global crony capitalists are trying to achieve, and also to insulate ourselves off natural disasters such as a solar flare hitting our electricity grid, which will happen one day, and we are not prepared for that. We would see everything shut down very quickly. No food, no fuel, no nothing. Same with fuel. Some sort of big war, which, well, it's obviously a potential. because it's happened many times before. So are we insulated against that? And the answer is no. We are unprepared for all these things. And so it's very important that we localise our economy, localise our industry through hemp, and I can elaborate on that in a moment, and also localise our food in ways that, you know, we're taking care of our fundamental staples and things we can to survive, and then you move out for trade that way. I'm not suggesting an end to trade or anything like that. It's just you've got to be smart about this process and look at what the risks we are facing, and not just in terms of how our societies could be really affected by certain things, but also about how we just genuinely care for ourselves. And right now, we are, you know, highly uneducated. We're losing life and health skills. Our communities are further disintegrated. We're warring each other. We're fighting each other. I can't mention certain things that I believe are, very important discussions in our day and age without being judged as some sort of, crazy...
Tinfoil hat.
Not even that. I mean, I use language that is, to the best of my ability, is, attractive. It's a language that people aren't pushed away from. I try and make it palatable, so I pose things as questions, as in terms of, instead of just going, this is our reality and look how dark and crazy it is, I really try and just present the information in a way that's going to be conducive to facilitating the shift in thinking and feeling that my audience and beyond probably need to go through. You know, we were all going through our own revolution of mind, body, energy, as I said before. And this is a journey of becoming more conscious. It isn't about coming to a destination. I don't believe we wake up. I believe that we're continuously waking up or going further to sleep. It just depends on, and we could be doing that around different issues. So we could be becoming more conscious about really important issues and then becoming less conscious about other important issues. So we're all on our own journey with that process. And I think if we can just understand that, accept that, and appreciate that within ourselves, then we're not fighting each other. We're not like, oh, look at you, you haven't learnt this information or whatever. It's like, well, how can I help you maybe to learn this information? Or maybe it's me that actually needs to learn the information, so I might need to stay open with the discourse so that that we can both learn, or that I have to go through the learning I have to go through. So I think if we had that general philosophy where we're all on our own, we're all on a certain stage of development, and we should be helping each other and working together to achieve what our sort of bigger goals are, then we're going to get along better. We're not going to have this abuse online, like domestic violence online. It's an absolute tragedy, a bad reflection of humanity. And we can actually just start talking and learning from each other and working together to make our future just something that we haven't even begun to imagine yet. So I'm hopeful about it, but we are at a critical fork in the road. We are either going into that monopolisation and globalisation, all those things I talked about before, or we're going to choose the opposite. We're going to choose sovereignty, localisation and decentralisation. And that's just the critical question and choice that we've all got to make right now.
Well, everything that you've said applies to New Zealand as well. So that's fantastic. And I've started a movement called Survival Movement NZ, which is on Facebook. And we'll be taking things there about localization and making us more food secure for a start. But just going back to Australia, how much is Australia becoming Little America?
Well, good question, a tough question. I think that we've been idealising America and celebratorium and just general the general structure, materiality and consumerism and whatnot for quite some time. There's a sense of, I guess, an awe in the general mainstream around America and just the general spread of that particular type of entertainment, I guess, almost, with celebrities and all the rest of it. In terms of policy and social or social system operation, but we've still got a lot of differences. And we've got similar problems, but they're quite different in different ways as well. There's huge power shifts going on right around the world at the moment, behind the scenes, and because ultimately humanity is fundamentally good, we're fundamentally negative in our own way as well, but we are not psychopaths in general. We are not people that want to hurt people in general. Humanity are a beautiful species on many levels. We've been corrupted and propagandized and indoctrinated to huge degrees, and we're still relatively great people. And I believe that that greatness of humanity exists right through the deep layers of government and corporations and all these institutions and whatnot. And I would like to imagine, with a sense of or a feeling of certainty, that there are people behind the scenes who are organising themselves to ensure that we do move in the right direction from this point forward. In terms of Australia's, and so that is exciting to me. I believe that's happening all around the world in different ways. It's sort of a symptom of the information dissemination networks we've got right now. So people are aware about what are the real problems we're facing, what are the sort of power structures that are in place, what are their actual activities, what are their results on the ground, and clearly there's not great results on the ground in many cases. And so it's exciting to think about us moving in the right direction at this point, but it comes down to, once again, the people. We need to be able to be driving this as well, not just people behind the scenes, but the people in general need to start properly educating themselves about a whole host of issues so that we can get on more or less a similar direction for how we move forward.
Somebody was looking at the work I'm doing with Survival NZ, Survival Movement NZ, and they said, oh, well, people aren't going to get on board until there's a disaster. Do you think that's true?
Yes. It depends on how you sell it. I think this is why I'm incredibly impressed by hemp. Let me put it this way. Let me start with this.
Hemp.
Mm-hmm. Hemp and cannabis and hemp, different strains of the same plant. We have an endocannabinoid system in our bodies, which has receptors on the cells to absorb the cannabinoids, which come from cannabis. So it is literally our companion plant. That's the definition of companion plant. You put tomatoes and basil together, and they help each other, or it's one way, regardless of which way it is. They help. There's an assistance process. And cannabis has that for us on a medicinal level because we produce our own cannabinoids in our body. However, we don't necessarily have them well balanced, or we don't have enough when we're experiencing illness or whatever, and that's where it can come into it. But not only that, it's also a companion plant on a resource level because we can create a huge majority of our resource needs. We can get rid of oil more or less completely and just go to, instead of oil-based plastics and fuels, you can go to hemp-based plastics and fuels. And a whole host of other biofuels, of course, as well. And it's cleaner, it's better for the environment, you can make it locally, it builds self-sufficiency into your system because you've got all the fuel you need in your local area. Very, very important in terms of the environmentalists. If they want to start taking care of the environment, then fuel, or oil, should I say, needs to be more or less removed from the system. We don't need it. It's not necessary. Not only that, paper, and we don't need to cut down 20, 30-year-old trees or older. Paper, we can just use hemp. The American Constitution was originally written on hemp. We've used hemp for eons. The only reason it was stolen from us was because nylon and cotton, those industries, didn't want to see hemp take off. Obviously, pharmaceuticals, because you can grow your own medicine in your own backyard, and they didn't want to. And most pharmaceuticals actually had cannabis in them for decades leading up to the early 1900s. So it's always been a medicine. Even the monopolies, the big pharma used it. But they, you know, they want to control. They want to synthesize and have. And most of their medicines come from plants and bacteria anyway. It just they've just synthesized it in a way that can be patented, so they can make money off it. Essentially, that's the profit-based model of big pharma, and we don't need that. There's some greatness to come out of it, sure, but we certainly need to have more source efficiency and connection with our plant medicines, our medicines. But not only that, the other industry was, of course, petrochemicals, because hemp doesn't need many, if at all, petrochemicals. It uses one-third the amount of what cotton uses in terms of water. And so it is a miracle plant for those. We don't need to cut down forests. We can make our paper out of it. We can make our clothing out of it. You can make even silk-type fabrics out of it. The textile sophistication is off the charts now. You can make entire cars out of it. In fact, you can create a hemp plastic that is so strong, it's 10 times stronger than steel. And there has been cars made out of it. In fact, Henry Ford made one back in 1943, I think it was. And so, and then obviously it got all shut down, and, you know, hemp bad, cannabis bad, and that was one of the biggest things that shifted our direction as a species. If we had unleashed cannabis and hemp when we at that stage, we would be a very, very different species, and we would not be warring like we have. If we can create most of our resources locally, then there's no need for people to have resource wars and oil wars and all this sort of stuff. So it was one of the biggest crimes against humanity that's ever happened, that is to be taken away from us. But the production value has gotten so good now that you can create hemp houses basically completely out of hemp, except for the frame. You use your wooden frame, and then everything else, paints, plasterboards, concrete or hempcrete, you name it, it's all made out of hemp. And not only is it lasts longer, like a 1,000-year lifespan, but it's fireproof. You can't set the thing on fire, and it's pest-proof. There's no termites getting in. There's no problems with, like, it's just phenomenal. And not only that, this, for those who are so concerned about carbon, which I'm not, I see it as a nutrient, and I think it's a bit, well, I'm at least open for the debate on the main stage about this, because there's a lot deeper modelling that hasn't been incorporated into the mainstream modelling. But just say that it is a massive issue, then what we need to do is use hemp, because the plant itself is a great carbon capturing device, but when you build it as a house, it continues to absorb carbon over its entire lifespan. So just by being a house, it's actually drawing carbon out of the atmosphere. So if that's a massive concern for people, then I'm not sure why they're not talking about hemp. But it's not just that. The list goes on. It is phenomenally powerful, including as a superfood. It's got one of the best balances of 369 omega. The fatty acids, the whole host of stuff. I'm no expert on that, but just to look into all that sort of stuff is just phenomenal. Hemp bread, for example, as well, would resolve so many issues that people have with bread across our world. But, yeah, it is just, the list goes on and on and on. Furniture, mattresses, carpets, the whole houses, as I mentioned. It is just beautifully powerful and a beautiful miracle plant. And so my position on all of it is that we need to start reincorporating that to revitalise local economies. You basically just go, I make a joke saying, Hemp Australia, mate. We're going to hemp, where we can start caring for our communities. We build our medicines, our foods, our cars, our houses, all of the industries around such a great plant that's so great for the environment as well. It draws out heavy metals from the soils. It cleans up, it makes the soils more productive for whatever crops come afterwards. You don't need the petrochemicals, as I said. It is amazing. And so I can't remember the actual original question that got me onto hemp, though, Lisa. If you want to remind me on that, and then I'll wrap it up from there.
I think I've forgotten too, because I've got so enthusiastic about hemp, actually. I'm just interested. Do you know if there's different varieties of hemp? Because, of course, if you only use one variety, you're a little bit more at risk. For example, the Irish potato famine, if you've only got one type of something. So there would need to be several different sorts of hemp, wouldn't there, in case of blights and disasters there?
Just like any plant, you've got dozens, if not hundreds of strains. So in more colder temperatures, you need a particular strain which is a bit more hardy to the cold.
Yeah.
It's just about brooding your variety according to your conditions, absolutely. There's many, many different versions of hemp. And, of course, they're so different that you've got sativa and indica, essentially, are the two main branches of it, whereas where one is the hemp and it's all about industrial hemp and for resources, and then one is about the medicinal quality, including the THC. But the medicinal CBD or the cannabinoids, as a whole, I think there's about 113 or so different cannabinoids in hemp and cannabis. And we haven't begun to really understand what all of these different cannabinoids can do for our system. So we're still learning about all that as well. But there are certainly different strains that can go into different areas and to ensure that we're protected from that sort of concern, I guess. I think what ultimately what I was getting at is that this really is about taking back our power as a people, and we are now so dependent, so sickly dependent on a sick system. We've got something what I call structural sickness, like structural unemployment. The same concept applies. The system is designed in a way, regardless of its purpose on purpose or not. The system is designed in a way that results with people being sick, stressed and sad. And it is very sad that there is so much of that, the three S's I call it, across our world, even in the so-called developed world or Western world. Like, we have a very sick society, and we're so dependent on these monopolistic structures, including the pharmaceuticals, that we're getting even sicker because it's a sick design. And so we need to reverse that. We need to go local. We need to care for ourselves on the ground and make sure we start reintegrating and upskilling and re-educating and doing all the stuff, getting people back out in nature and getting some sun onto them and getting them to really enjoy their process of connecting with their food and their resources, what we have for millennia. And so a big part of the what I call it is we're facing a collective existential crisis, whereas we're almost like all of us, you know, a huge portion of the world are going through a constant midlife crisis where they've lost meaning, they've lost purpose. They've got many different symptoms of that existential crisis. It could be sexual dysfunction, or it could be whatever physical sickness or mental health problem or whatever it is. But ultimately, when we lose our connection to nature, to who we are and to a community, to the level we have, there's going to be massive associated illness with that. But to take the... Go back to the original question, because I think I've remembered it now. I think it was about in terms of looking after ourselves in case of any hiccup, financial...
Disasters,
or
yes.
Environmental or whatnot. We are so dependent on the system. It is very, very dangerous for us to be so dependent. And I think it's just, it's like, the analogy I use is like, if you live in an environment where there's people that might want to try and rob your house, you don't wait until the person comes to the front door and say, well, I'm just going to lock my door now. You're not coming in. Like, you lock your door in general. Right? And that's important that we understand that we are faced with some risks. And whether or not this happens in our lifetime or not, there will eventually be a super volcano that goes off, which just the amount of greenhouse emissions and that alone would go beyond what we've ever done or probably could ever do. But then, of course, there's solar flares in the grid, there's tsunamis, comets, these things happen. And then, of course, the grand solar minimum, which is coming on, we're going into this cycle now where over the next 20 years or so we might face significant crop losses on a global stage. You might lose 10-20% of crop production, and that doesn't seem like too bad, but if we don't have systems in place to deal with that, then it's going to be really bad.
Well, it's so going to be really bad for poor people because the food prices will go up, and so some of us will be able to afford to eat and some won't, and that's atrocious.
And that's why we need to grow hemp, because hemp's a food, it's a superfood. The seed itself is 33% protein. So great for your vegans and vegetarians, but even people in third world poverty stricken areas, they grow their hemp, they've got their food. Hemp can solve world poverty right now. It's the policy makers, the people who are in control, who are not allowing this to be unleashed on their country. That's what it really comes down to. The people who are have been propaganda, and they might think they're doing the right thing, but they're not. This is a massive revolution that we're about to go through. In terms of greening our planet, it's going to be through hemp. That's the transition we need to go through, because it can resolve so many issues. It would help us chill the hell out a little bit, because this whole warring with each other over oil and these other resources, we can just really relax all of that and appreciate that we can localize most of our stuff if we so choose. And then we can just all get along and look after our own cultures and values and whatnot. You know, we're never going to all come to the same position about philosophically, metaphysically, on a religious level, whatever. And that's fine. We're allowed to have our differences. But we should be respecting each other and respecting ourselves enough to be able to take care of ourselves the best we can. And that's where hemp's going to play a marvelous role in that. And not only that, cannabis as an actual medicine, in terms of even the THC, is very, very powerful as a medicine, and I wouldn't recommend it to people who are experiencing significant mental health concerns such as psychosis and other conditions of that nature, because THC is not good for them whatsoever. Cannabinoids are, because it's non-psychoactive and it just goes about helping the endocannabinoid system. In terms of just all the aggression and fighting with alcohol and whatnot, give people a joint, just get them to relax a little bit, you know, we'd be all getting along a lot more peacefully, and we'd be able to get rid of the pharmaceutical takeover of our medicinal regime, because it is so powerful on a heap of levels, and therefore, you know, you're not dying. Nobody's ever died from cannabis ever in the history of cannabis use. You just cannot die from it. That's just the way it works with the system, with our body. So not only would you be helping people to not have the alcoholism and all those problems, but you would also get people off the pharmaceutical regimes, which are killing people en masse, like huge, huge levels. So I cannot emphasise this enough. I think it's just an absolute miracle that it's one of our best mates. It is just phenomenal, marijuana or mother cannabis. And we should really start respecting that over the next years and decades.
Well, I'm not such a fan on marijuana for younger people, but we won't go there because that's not the topic.
I wouldn't agree that young people should be smoking cannabis at all.
No.
I think the cannabinoids are different because you're not having a psychoactive effect. So if there are kids with seizure issues, like has been clearly clinically shown, then absolutely give them the cannabinoids, isn't it? It's just like taking I don't know, like a bit of turmeric or something, you know, like you don't get high off it.
The medicine aspect of it is absolutely fine. But I'm going to stop you there because I just want to say that this is Green Planet FM and I'm Lisa Eyre and I'm interviewing on the phone Australian Philip J. Watt, who has the most fantastic ideas about so many things. So, moving on from hemp, what about corruption in the world? How are we going to tackle that? So I'm gone to an entirely different topic, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine.
But you've got so much to say on so many things.
Well, what I would say about that is, in Australia, it's the best way I could speak to this question, is that we've got the 1900 Constitution. And that Constitution is very, very clear about the activities of the Parliament and the government. And so, it is in people's nature to want to be a little bit greedy and selfish and want more power and all those sorts of things. That's a natural part of being a human being. The system is geared in a way that almost rewards that sort of behaviour. So we need to sort of change that in terms of, well, you're actually going to be rewarded more if you actually help your community sort of thing. So this is a big, big question because it's about... really, it's just about the pleasure aspect. People are wanting to lessen pleasure and maximise pain, and they do that through various mechanisms in whatever situation they're in. At the moment, going back to our constitution, we just need to align our government activities to that we can get some proper, policies and ideas into the way that we operate, so that there is less interest of going into politics because you're doing more of a community service. It's not to get power, if that makes sense. And so if we shift the way that politicians are paid and what powers they do have, and the need for them to be aligned with their community wishes, then you're going to have less people go into those jobs who are doing it for power and money only, and instead they're doing it on behalf of their communities. There's another way you could do this as well. I think it's a multi-layered approach to doing this. You've got to shift the psyche of the collective, essentially, and what sort of energetic signatures you're feeding within particular structures, organisational structures. And so, for example, at the moment we celebrate the finance industry and lawyers and accountants and all these sorts of industries that can be helpful in many ways, but they can also be very parasitic, especially with the theft of private banking. We need to go to a public national public bank model, ASAP, look, the former CBA in Australia, and distribute a decentralised network of local public banks, which is pretty much the same model that you've got right now with banking. It's just that you give, instead of the profits going into foreign shareholders and stakeholders, including foreign banks, they just go back into the community to deal with homelessness and drug addiction and entrenched poverty and many of our other issues, including just infrastructure builds and whatnot as well.
Well, we in New Zealand have the Reserve Bank, which could do our money creation. And, yeah, the idea of local banks is fantastic. But most of the money from banking in New Zealand goes to Australia because we have the four big Australian banks here.
Yeah, but most of those big four, the big four are mostly foreign-owned. They're mostly the shareholders of the big four foreign banks and other foreign players and oligarchs and whatnot. So most of the money for money creation in Australia and New Zealand go overseas, and that's a really big issue. So we could shift our banking sector so that we have good competition with the private banks. They're allowed to be there if they want, but people are going to want to shop with banks that help out their communities, not make the rich richer. So we need to bring that back ASAP, and they need to be run, local public banks need to be run by local communities, not by local government, by local communities who distribute the money according to what their needs are on the ground. And yeah, so going back to the issue around corruption, I think that if we start respecting some of the more community service-based jobs, like mentoring and counselling, and, of course, hypnopsychotherapy, which I do, that needs to be a big integrated deep into our mainstream treatment protocols. But just nursing and policing and teaching and all that stuff, social workers, that whole community service industry needs to have more respect than what they've got in terms of economic advantage. And this parasitic finance sectors that are basically rigging and scamming the system, which they've always done through the lobbying industry and whatnot, that needs to be held in less esteem than what we do right now in terms of they're getting paid and whatnot. So we can have policies to shift to a more maternal type society. And when I say maternal, I don't mean women over men. Maternal in terms of men and women being very equal and respected in terms of the different roles that they give. Even though some men are more feminine, that's absolutely fine. They might have that more maternal nurture instinct, and more women might have more masculinity or more testosterone in them. And it's always a balance on all these different levels. But I think we should go back to, which we used to have on many different ancient civilizations in the timeline, more respect for the maternal aspect and really build in that into the system, and then you're less likely to have corruption because the reward and pleasure system is about helping people, not just helping people but helping yourself. But you sort of start integrating, oh well, helping others is actually helping myself. And so that's a big shift that our social system, if designed properly, would automatically sort of decrease the corruption in our world.
And what led me from the hemp to the corruption was actually the alcohol industry, because you were talking about marijuana, and I'm sure that the alcohol industry is the one that has very much blocked the hemp industry in a way, because, or the cannabis. So going on from there, though, what about the media? Because I feel there's corruption there.
You know, the media monopolies are owned by multi-billionaires who disseminate information according to their agendas. Like, that is not rocket science for any person to understand. In fact, the 2018 Trust, Edelman Trust Barometer in Australia, which is, I think, 18 or 19 year annually run survey, not just in Australia but around the world, it said that two-thirds of Australians don't trust the media and the government. And now, obviously, people are frustrated with these talking heads, both on the media and government. But they still tend to trust them in sort of action with a lot of the narratives that they do spew. A lot of these narratives is there are meta narratives, which I was sort of referring to before, the discourse that's happening on the ground, the big picture stuff, the big system stuff in terms of philosophy around freedom and practicalities around solutions and realities around actual problems and scamming of the system. All this is not included in the mainstream media. You might get little glimpses of it here and there, you can piece together some information from there, but ultimately they are doing the bidding of their billionaire owners, and they know it, the journalists know it, that there's absolutely times, maybe even several, where they tried to run a story and they were told no. They would feel that within themselves. And so the journalists need to take some responsibility about this and take some risks. But ultimately, there's two things that I believe we need to do in terms of to circumnavigate censorship and to make sure that we've got access to a free flow of information. The first thing is an Internet Bill of Rights. And we can, in Australia, we more or less need at least a recognition of a Bill of Rights in our Constitution, which is related back to the 1688 version and the Magna Carta, but that's another story. But the world needs an Internet Bill of Rights. We need to decentralise the Internet. We need to make sure that these corporations aren't controlling the information through their ideological persuasions. Like, you guys aren't the arbiter of truth. We determine what the truth is ourselves, for ourselves, and so we need all the information to be able to make that decision, that informed decision. And so these big monopolies are killing themselves, the Facebooks and Googles and Twitters and whatnot. They will be, they're shooting themselves in the foot right now. I don't know how this is going to turn out. I assume they'll either adapt or die, because people are too conscious about this sort of stuff. You just can't control the narrative without having the fair consequence or balancing to that. So that's number one, Internet Bill of Rights. The other big thing that I've heard about this in America, I'm the first person that I'm aware of to be speaking about it in Australia. But essentially, we've got a postal network called Australia Post. In America, it's called the USPS or United States Postal Service. And one of the original sort of design elements to these systems was that in case there's any sort of dictatorial government that ever emerges, you can basically still ensure the free flow of information through these postal networks so that people can organise and revolt against any dictatorship. And so that was one of its original mandates. And at the moment, it's not doing that role in the digital age. So what I would like to see is the Australia Post Network transition to the digital age. And what that means is incorporating public software and hardware packages into that network, into that framework. So software, emails, services, social media and media platforms, and then hardware such as the physical communication lines and antennas and whatnot, servers for the information, all that sort of thing. And so if we built it into the Australia Post network, and had worked under some sort of decentralized technology such as blockchain or whatever it happened to be, so that there is, we can circumnavigate all the censorship by government, by a dinosaur media, and by a new sort of big tech media, then we can resolve these issues forever. And so, and in terms of the actual media monopolies, look, I don't know. I'm not an expert at this enough to know how we might be able to break them apart in terms of decentralise them and break them up because of their monopolistic structure. But I'm sure there could be policies to do that as well.
I think the one thing that just worries me a little bit with that is that people then go to non-mainstream media, but some of it is a little bit extreme, and you wonder whether it's actually researched. I mean, for example, Alec Jones's channel that's been shut down. I mean, some of the stuff he said was good, and some of the stuff he said I just didn't relate with. So it's really a question of being discerning, isn't it?
Yeah, that's where it comes to the education of society. We need to give, we should be encouraging the population to be educated, to look after their intellectual health, to access all the, we need all the information laid out at the table so that we can make informed decisions. We need evidence from all accounts to be put on the table for mainstream debate. Yes, there's definitely propaganda issues and other serious issues within independent media, most definitely. A big issue with the conspiratorial culture is that they've gotten so, disenfranchised that they automatically, some people can automatically just take on a truth that is more or less outright insane. But they're just so distrusting of the mainstream narrative that they'll take on anything in the independent narrative. And so, once again, that's a reflection of what happens when you're pretty much suppressing. So, whilst there's a lot of bad ideas, maybe some from Alex Jones or whoever, it doesn't matter. If we put it into the darkness, if we suppress it, then it festers, right? And so, a good saying that I think is applicable in this discussion is, sunlight is the best disinfectant. And so we need to expose all of these ideas and allow people to express their whatever it may be. Of course, there are legal consequences and karmic consequences for inciting violence with your speech, and that's fair enough. I would never debate against that whatsoever. If you cause harm, physical harm through what you're doing, through your words, then, well, there's consequences to that. But ultimately, everything else, if it's just an idea, be it a bad idea, it should be allowed to be discussed. And that's the point, is to debate it. And then you debate these bad ideas and the best ideas are going to win out. So it's very important that we really look at this from a philosophical point of view and say, well, there is no arbitrator of the truth. So we need to make sure all ideas are allowed open for discourse. And there are consequences, legal consequences, to hurting anybody with your words. It comes down to a pretty simple philosophy for me.
Yes, it's quite simple to me, but I think other people are a little bit more... there's a lot of discussion, really. What is hate speech and what is free speech?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not even sure. It's hard to determine that because, you're allowed to not agree with certain ideologies. You're allowed to say those ideologies are shit if you want. And, some people consider that hate speech, and that's just ridiculous. There's many toxic ideas and ideological frameworks out there, and you either resonate with it or you don't. If you don't, you think it's a terrible way of thinking and feeling and behaving. And you're allowed to be critical of it. So, I would appreciate that people use better language and communication skills in general. I've advocated for a long time now that the best way to approach a debate and to people in general is to not engage fight, fright or flight, because you're never, ever going to get the result that you want. you've got to be open and be compassionate and empathetic with your communication, and then you might get a result of that person learning something. And not only that, by doing that approach, maybe you'll realise it was you that was wrong. And so that you've got to, by being open and compassionate, you like, and both parties doing that, then suddenly if it's an issue of disagreement, it might just end up with agreeing to disagree, but it might end up in actual further education for one or both parties. And so, I certainly don't agree with... personally, I don't use speech and language that is designed to offend or is designed to be hateful or designed to be any of those sorts of things. But, for example, comedy is a really good one. A comedy needs to be able to be controversial and to take on these ideas and challenge these ideas in the way that they do. So it's a good reflection of how we can... how free speech needs to be maintained and almost done in a way that's it's an enjoyable way of putting the discourse out there.
Yes, you've got an hilarious Australian comedian who's very political. I forget his name now, but I've very much enjoyed his putting out some pretty extreme stuff most humorously. It's a really good idea. So we're coming near the end of the interview. And I want to go back to localising and working together regardless of our political persuasions. And you say that we need an intelligent plan. I'm looking at what you've written here. What could you advise us as an intelligent plan, apart from hemp? Because we've covered that one.
Yeah, that's okay. Well, we've started... I think the right place to start is to identify the macro issues and the macro solutions, which I've already done. And to reverse monopolisation, globalisation, we need to localise. To reverse centralisation, we need to decentralise. And because there's authoritarianism issues, both on an individual and a national and international scale, we need to celebrate what individual freedom and national freedom really is. And individual freedom comes down to simply... each individual has a supreme authority over themselves while still being held accountable to doing no harm unless in self-defence. There's nuances to it, of course. It's not black and white on every level, but more or less that's how your social system should be designed around, is that just everybody can do whatever the hell they want, do whatever you want, just don't harm people. That's pretty much the basic concept to it. And so that is one of the deeper philosophies we need to have within ourselves and build into the social system properly. We're meant to be in a free society, and if we don't have this, then are we really in a free society? So, moving on though.
I've only got one more minute, Philip.
Okay, sure. We need to make sure that we're bringing our parliament into alignment with our rule book. The constitution is the document gives the government the authority to exist in the first place. So we need to go back to that altogether. But in terms of localisation, it's about local resource production, it's about local public banks, it's about localised medicine, localised fuels and energy, and localised media a lot more as well. And basically getting the community together and educating them over particular issues and debating those issues so that they can come to sort of a coherence together in the communities as to what they want there, and then that needs to be enacted. Their will needs to be enacted by those people that should be representing their needs and their wants. So, look, I could obviously talk for a long time about Lisa, but I do appreciate...
time limits.
Get as much as I can out.
Look, this has been absolutely awesome. I really love all your ideas, and you express them so coherently. Thank you so much for being on the other end of the phone.
My absolute pleasure, Lisa.
Thank you again. That was Philip J. Watt, interviewed by me, Lisa Eyre, for Green Planet FM.
one